All right, good morning, everybody. Today is, I think it's Tuesday, January 30th, 2018, and this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Tuesday, everyone. It is a chilly 20 degrees with light snow fog here in upstate New York. Got a couple inches last night, but it had been pretty nice over the last few days, but winter is back. So where do we leave off on Friday? It was Robot Friday, we dubbed it. We titled the show CES Robots, Fabio Sausage Fail, Obsolete Humans, and 100% Deduction. We looked at a bunch of different things, some of our favorite topics, robots, the brain, and artificial intelligence, and how all of these pieces connect together. And there were quite a number of robots that were out and about. We found out that Walmart is going to implement robots to do inventory 2 minutes per aisle. And it can telescope to up to 6 feet in the aisle, which would be pretty interesting to see. But also at the Consumer Electronics Show in Vegas, they had launched a bunch of different robots. And we saw that Fabio, who was in a grocery store in, I think it was Ireland, was scaring customers away and they had to fire him. And he couldn't even give out sausages. Humans wouldn't take them. We also discovered that there was part of the new tax law that was just passed that gives a 100% upfront business deduction to companies that automate tasks with robots or artificial intelligence and replaces human jobs. So where's that going to leave you? Robots are going to take all the jobs and the companies will be economically incented. And then we kind of ended up looking at a neuromorphic atomic switch made out of silver, I believe. And we had looked at this one a couple times. This is a different story than the first time we had read it, where the silver actually grows in a chaos almost to connect to the most important regions of the circuit to almost mimic a human brain at an atomic level. And then we took a look at MIT making brain cell connections that behave just like human connections. So where we ended is we started looking at a story about the dangers of being exponential. This was written by his pen name is Socrates, but he also does a podcast. His name is Nikolov, and I never remember his last name. Hold on. Nikolov Danilov. And we have replayed him a couple times on this show in a place of me being live. I'm going to try to get him on as a guest one of these days. But it seems that recently, and I always kind of liked his philosophical take looking at artificial intelligence and how this is going to affect us as a species, but he started to take a pretty critical look lately at Singularity University, which I find surprising because I think he had done lectures and stuff there at one point. But I want to share this with you because this echoes a lot of what I've been saying and also gives some caution. And again, another person who is well aware of the industry and what is happening and starting to question where this is headed. All right, so this is titled On Singularity University and the Danger of Being Exponential. This is out of his blog, singularityweblog.com, January 14th, 2018. Singularity University has a religious fetish for its sacred words, and those would be disrupt, innovate, and most of all, exponential. And remember, that is the organization that has Kurzweil and Peter Diamandis involved to talk about the future of abundance that the singularity is going to bring. We'll be able to sit around and just eat grapes, being fed by our robot assistants who can bring us beers as well. We found out Friday. So just listen to any recent Singularity University alumni, and you can't help it but hear disrupt here, innovate there, most of all, exponential everywhere. This is not surprising since even before updating its massively transformative purpose to, quote, be exponential, Singularity University was the temple proselytizing the gospel of exponential technology. And he's very right. This is turning into a religion. We did look at I don't remember his last name. It was Polish. The former Google and one of the automated car service executives was launching his own, Lewandowski was his name, launching his own church of AI. So when AI becomes smarter than us, when we actually reach that singularity, it will look upon us beneficially because we'll all be in line and kissing its feet where we should be in the future food chain. The problem with such shallow-minded slogans, and that would be exponential, is be careful what you ask for, is that people might end up doing just that. And it could be the end of us all, because while it is necessary, technology is not enough. You see, the Black Death, a.k.a. the Black Plague, was exponential. The Spanish flu was also exponential. And we've talked a lot about outbreaks and pandemics. Interesting you brought those up. And they were very lucky that neither SARS nor Ebola went exponential. Yeah, weren't we all? During the respective outbreaks a few years ago, Al-Qaeda was pretty innovative in their attacks. And ISIS was still pretty disruptive, not only in the Middle East, but also across the globe, even whether or not it was a psyop or if it was our creation. He didn't add those. But when you urge us to be exponential, innovative, and disruptive, are you suggesting that we should be like the Great Plague, the Spanish flu, Al-Qaeda, or ISIS? And, you know, this is like to serve man. Kind of an open-ended edict that if you don't put any boxes around it and kind of try to direct what you mean by your words, it could end up being something that you did not intend. So he's bringing up a very good point. I hope it is clear that we can be disruptive, we can be innovative, and we can be exponential, and we can still cause the extinction of all life on our planet. So simply being exponential is not just meaningless, it is outright dangerous. So he's calling Singularity University dangerous. Therefore, my concern that we are putting the stress on the wrong word within be exponential is not merely semantics. Unfortunately, however, I am afraid this slogan captures well and is a direct result of Singularity University's general confusion of the means with an end. Why else would Singularity University move away from, quote, solving humanity's grand challenges, which must have been their old tagline, a noble end in itself, to be exponential, an instrument as a means to an end? So being exponential is just that, a means to an end. In fact, all technology is but a means to an end, never an end in itself, because we don't do things in order to get more technology. On the contrary, we develop new technology in order to get other more meaningful goals, like diminish suffering, and these, of course, are all the ways they're selling it, living a good life, and ultimately being happy. So when we say be exponential or be disruptive or be innovative, it is just like saying be technology, be a tool, be a means to an end. Zing! And it is an empty slogan that spreads confusion and dangerously shifts the focus away from the proper end goal itself. Take disruption, for example. We cannot, or at least should not, disrupt the food, water, energy supplies of San Francisco just for the case of disruption. And just like Facebook should not disrupt the presidential elections, wink, no matter how innovative and exponential they may be at doing that. So disrupting is not an end in itself. It is at best a means, and therefore you don't have something constructive to create as soon as you have finished disrupting. You may end up doing a lot more harm than good, right? You create a power vacuum. Ergo, being constructive is the more important part that we ought to always begin to pay more attention to, even though it is always harder to accomplish. Technology is a magnifying mirror because it has no essence of its own. It simply takes and amplifies the essence we give it. So be careful. So instead of focusing on improving the mirror, we ought to focus on improving the image we ourselves project in it, right? Humanity is not trustworthy, and that would be, i.e., who we are being and what we are doing. Ultimately, it is not about technology. It is about us. Call me a short-sighted linear thinker, but my fear is that be exponential demonstrates how Singularity University is forgetting that technology is just a magnifying mirror, and it is exposing who we are, but it is not changing our fundamental essence. It merely amplifies it. So if we're garbage in, garbage out, if we were evil, it's going to spit out even more evil with technological innovation added as a few sprinkles. So if we put in garbage, and even says this, but this was a term we used to use all the time in the tech world. If we put in garbage, then we're going to get garbage out. But now it is exponential garbage. And if we are not careful with what it is that we are taking exponential, be it CO2, plastic pollution, gray goo, it can be the end of its all. This is the danger of merely thinking exponentially. So let's add a little more spice to this. Go back a few years. The Davos meeting in Switzerland took place last week. And we didn't cover a lot of that, but they talked a lot about nanotechnology and artificial intelligence. And George Soros came out and bitch slapped Google and Facebook. So there was a scientist. He had been the director of the MIT Media Lab at the time, and this was back in January of 2013, who came out and spoke at Davos in January of 2013. His name was Ito. His last name was Ito, I-T-O. It's out of CNET.com. January 25th, 2013. Think twice about immortality and the singularity. He's calling it out as well. The director of the MIT Media Lab said that science fiction visions of computers and humans emphasize the wrong priorities for development. Technological progress should aim for resilience, not efficiency. So Ray Kurzweil's vision of the singularity, when nanobots make humans immortal and computers progress so fast that the future becomes profoundly unknowable, is a bad idea. That is perhaps surprisingly contrary to the opinion of Joichiro Ito, who is as a high-tech investor and the director of the MIT Media Lab, and he might expectedly be a natural ally. The lab, after all, aims to be the center of today's technological innovation, and Ito, speaking today at the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, said that he believes that the singularity vision puts the wrong priorities first. I bet he got chased out of MIT Media Lab not long after that. I am on the side of the singularity, guys. I don't think immortality is a good thing. Oh, I'm on the other side of the singularity, guys. I don't think immortality is a good thing, Ito said. People who think about maximizing efficiency, quote, don't think about the ecological social network effects. And in the future, every science invention we do should at least be neutral or preferably positive. So when you introduce immortality, you have to think about what that does to the whole system. And at the Media Lab, our design principle is not to make the world more efficient, but to make the system more resilient and more robust. Ito called for a radically restructured educational system as well. You are training kids to become obedient members of a mass production society, he said. Wow, he got a target on his back after this one. But there is more and more automation, and you want people to be more creative, like kindergarten, when children spend more time playing around, exploring, and teaching each other. Tests today judge kids in a computer-free testing environment completely unrelated to what is in the real world, unless you go to some elementary and middle schools where they're giving them all notebooks to take home without any parental controls. But today, you can look on the internet and you can ask your friends, and cheating is actually a feature. Success as an adult is how resourceful you are at getting people to help you do things. Those are all unassessed things in today's schools and on tests. So he's talking about crowdsourcing. The MIT Media Lab favors a more unstructured approach. Our students and our faculty can explore whatever they want. We just tell them go, he said. And if you're not asking permission and writing proposals, then the cost of innovation is very low. Students can talk about ideas in the morning. By the afternoon, they built a prototype. And especially with the increasing utility of 3D printers, Edo had grand visions for how those printers will change manufacturing, and we are going to be manufacturing things everywhere instead of centrally, right, this decentralized, democratized everything across the planet. Every single person is going to become a designer, he predicts. The technology should help people rethink what is possible with cities, he also said. People able to page buses on demand, bus stops should be created on demand, not fixed in advance. Rentable commuter bicycles should be cheaper, too, to use them if people drop them off in high-demand areas. When I went to Amsterdam many years ago, that's how they had it. There were just free bicycles laying all over the place, and you could just take one and go take your bike, and then when you got to your destination, there was typically some bike racks to put the used bike in. So while they are trying to look at a city from a software perspective and build the hardware around it. So where does that leave us? Well, just because you can be exponential doesn't mean that that is such a good thing. Just because we can maybe figure out how to merge with the machine, that is not such a good thing either. But don't worry about it, because Billy Gates pops up like a little whack-a-mole again, January 26, 2018. In a recent interview, Bill Gates is convinced that artificial intelligence will make our lives better and easier. Right, just because he says so. In a recent interview, billionaire Bill Gates had this to say about artificial intelligence and how it would affect the future of work. And I remember he came out not too long ago and had mentioned that we should tax the robots, but we found out that taxing the robot, when looked at by a tax professional lawyer, it was a story read a few days back, wasn't such a good idea, and I don't exactly remember why, but look back in the archives. So, all right, this is what Billy says, quote, "Well, certainly we can look forward to the idea that vacations will be longer at some point, yeah, or maybe even permanent. And we can actually produce twice as much as we make today with less labor. And the purpose of humanity is not just to sit behind a counter and sell things, you know?" That's what he said. But you know, when the tech bubble burst way back when, early 2000s, and then again in like 2006, I remember Microsoft changing their tagline. I remember what their original one was, but then they had changed their tagline to "Do more with less." Because we had to lay half the people off, and everybody had to do now six jobs. And they changed it to "Do more with less," and let our technology help you do that. So it isn't an interesting idea, considering that nearly every time technology has been introduced, it didn't actually do that, like make our lives more carefree and less labor and more things to do. Workers simply began to do something else or became unemployed. And work hours here in the U.S. have increased despite the evidence that longer work hours actually make workers less effective. And I can also tell you, affects their health. In countries, so it will be increasing our health bill. In countries with more social democratic models like France, Denmark, and Germany, especially in those with universal basic income, ding ding, it could indeed have something like that effect. Because of higher productivity, mandated vacations, and sick days, the limits to a work week, folks in those countries get a lot more time off than workers in the United States. But however, in a country that is based around people needing to perform whatever work they can in order to not be homeless, it is not likely to have that kind of effect. Just take a look at how productivity is increased for workers in the U.S. compared with wages. And we have hourly compensation looking like it is staying pretty stagnant. I don't know where the table of contents is that tells me which is the dark blue line and which is the light blue line. But this is refute the idea that the productivity means more money in the pocket of those doing the work and even more vacation time, because it didn't. AI will cost jobs. But where it remains to be seen is how dramatic those losses will be. We already are seeing a number of retail jobs basically shrink every week as more brick-and-mortar shops close their doors, largely because Amazon and others ship directly to customers, saving people the quote-unquote inconvenience of going to retail stores to buy the new book or the new pair of jeans, yeah, or your pet food. I mean, guys, honestly, I was a very early adopter of online shopping. I used to do my Christmas shopping back in the days when you could find free shipping for just about everything. because they were trying to promote online shopping. I found that Christmas shopping at Christmas time was really convenient, as long as I didn't have to go to any store in the mall, which I always hated with a passion. But now it's really caught on, and remember, we also read about, with all these newfangled voice-activated home assistants, you can now shop online from the convenience of your living room or while you are driving one of your new self-driving vehicles. With the launch of Amazon's self-checkout store in Seattle, even more of these jobs are likely to disappear. And in reality, it becomes an evolving job market. And those at the low end of the game will have to find something else they can do, including picking strawberries for probably close to the same wages. Even Gates acknowledges this, quote, in case of adjusting and having a safety net that works so people can get retrained, it will be challenging, unquote. And I guess that's the end of that lame-ass story. But talking about Bill Gates, this one caught my attention. We had read quite extensively about Bill Gates, some of the gene drives, and the Bill Melinda Gates Foundation global philanthropy to try to eradicate malaria. They have spent a lot of time, effort, and money on that quote-unquote noble goal. Well, check this out. This came out January 21st, 2018. Toothpaste ingredient, and yes, an ingredient that still should not be in your toothpaste. So take a look, because if it is in there, chuck the toothpaste out. And that would be a compound, an antibacterial called triclosan, which they had pulled out of the market, out of hand soap, because they found that it did some shit to your liver. Toothpaste ingredients may help curb drug-resistant malaria, finds AI-powered robot. Its ability to target two points in the malaria parasite's life cycle means that the parasite will find it difficult to evolve resistance, says lead researcher Dr. Elizabeth Bisland. A laboratory robot powered by artificial intelligence has discovered that a compound commonly found in toothpaste, should never be in toothpaste, could be used to combat drug-resistant malarial parasites. Triclosan could be deployed against strains of Plasmodium malaria parasites that have evolved resistance to a widely used drug named primethylamine, according to the University of Cambridge. And that would be that Oxford University where they developed Oxitec, where they developed the genetically modified mosquitoes to combat all of those mosquito diseases that are becoming epidemic across our globally warmed environment. Primethylamine works by inhibiting a particular enzyme called DHFR, and scientists have known for some time that triclosan can be employed to target another enzyme called ENR. The fast-moving AI routines of the robot named Eve, however, which formulate, test, and reevaluate hypotheses in quick succession, discovered that the common toothpaste chemical also attacks DHFR, even in parasites resistant to pyrimethylamine. It has led researchers to hope that triclosan could be developed for use in a two-pronged attack on Plasmodium in the liver and in the blood. And lead study author Dr. Elizabeth Bisland, now an assistant professor at the University of Campinas in Brazil, how convenient that she is in Brazil, where they are also tinkering. I think there is one of those genetically modified mosquito factories there as well. Said, quote, the discovery by our robot's colleague, Eve, that triclosan is effective against malarial targets offers hope that we may be able to use it to develop a new drug. We know it is a safe compound. Well, I would beg to differ with that. And its ability to target two points in the malaria's parasite life cycle means that the parasite will find it difficult to evolve resistance. As long as they're going to use it on the parasite and not on humans, it might be okay. And drug-resistant malaria is becoming an increasingly significant threat in Africa, of course, and in Southeast Asia, and our medicine chest of effective treatments is slowly depleting. The search for new medicines is becoming increasingly urgent, and malaria kills more than 500,000 people per year. So they never mentioned Billy Gates in here. But it's interesting, because he was just touting how AI is going to make us all happier and healthier. And, of course, that is one of his big things, is fighting malaria. Oh, hold on. I just had a video start. All right, so continuing on a little bit about Davos. At Davos, there was a scientist who came out, and I may have mentioned him. This doesn't have his name quickly available. Feringa is his name. Feringa spoke to CBS at Davos January 25th, 2018. The title of this article is Tiny Robots That Save Lives. The future has never looked smaller. And he gives a talk all about little nanobots in the future. And remember, Davos is the World Economic Forum. This is where all your big business leaders and government officials all meet and greet and drink champagne and eat caviar to decide what technologies they're all going to invest in and push on global timelines to roll out as a net to drop over us. In the future, physicians will have an army of health aides small enough to fit on the head of a pin. We will have these tiny robots, and the doctors will inject them into your blood, and they will move and go find tumor cells or go repair something or deliver a drug with high precision, says Dutch chemist and Nobel laureate Bernard Fingena, while noting that such technology is still likely 4 to 5 decades away. I am working on nanoscience, so making all kinds of machines and motors with all kinds of gadgets at the scale of a nanometer, which is 1/1,000,000,000th of a meter, says Feringa, who got his Nobel Prize in 2016, along with two others, for work developing the world's first molecular machines. So I bet he's a friend of, what's his name, the father of nanotechnology from MIT. I keep forgetting his name. Feringa spoke with CBS Money Watch from Davos, Switzerland, where he's a part of a European Research Council delegation to this year's World Economic Forum, holds two fingers practically touching to illustrate a millimeter. Then try to visualize something that is a million times smaller to reach the nanoscale, he says. Funded by the Economic Research Council starting in 2008, the University of Groningen in the Netherlands professor has used molecular motors to rotate glass cylinders 10,000 times bigger than the motors. The molecular motor can be likened to where the electric motor stood in the 1830s. When scientists came up with various spinning cranks and wheels, not knowing what they would eventually lead to, but inventions including washing machines and food processors. The smartphone is another example of world-changing technology based on advances in physics and chemistry that came a half century before the mobile gadget came into existence. And while there are 80,000 nanometers on a human hair, this is what we learned in the last 20 years. We didn't know how to make tiny machines, said the professor. And he wholly likened the miniaturization to writing, quote, a whole library on a human hair. We have to go to a sustainable society, he says, and that's the key phrase and why he is speaking at Davos. And it gives us a strong responsibility, the people who do inventions, who do discoveries, and who do innovation. So striking an optimistic note, he says, let me remind you, creativity and imagination is sustainable beyond any doubt. So creativity and imagination, exponential futures are all going to be what get us to this next level and keep us from destroying ourselves. Now that's going to take us to the next one. So I just skipped a couple stories because this one connects better. This was out of Scientific American, and I want to say thank you to a very good friend of mine who must have read my mind and actually got me a full year subscription, not only digitally, but also in print. You know how long it's been since I've had an imprint magazine? I used to get all of the science publications back in the 80s and the 90s, but it'll be sweet to actually have Scientific American again. So we got a whole year that's going to start coming here soon. This is out of Scientific American, January 25th, 2018. For AI to get creative, it must learn the rules and then how to break them. That's what you got to love to hear. Teaching AI to be deviant. New artificial intelligence systems are using what they call adversarial networks. And we read about this. This is how that AlphaGo is learning. Google's super intelligent artificial intelligence that can beat the world champion in the world's most complicated game. I actually watched a documentary that was on Netflix on that about a week ago. And I got to tell you, it wasn't that good. A lot of it took place in South Korea, I believe, where the world champion is from. And there were a lot of people speaking with very thick accents, so it was kind of hard to follow at times. I think there may have been subtitles as well. But I got to tell you, in watching that, it really kind of pulled at your heartstrings if you were on the side of the meatbags, which I was, because it was pretty challenging. And these people had spent their entire lives, because this was so central to their culture, this game Go. It had been around for thousands and thousands of years, and it was a mark of intelligence. And they started learning it very, very young. It taught them a lot of skills on how to think on their feet. And to lose is quite a, I don't know if you'd call it an insult, but it actually caused them some shame. And so when the world champion lost multiple times to Google's artificial intelligence that was learning by competing against itself with its, what they call an adversarial network. It's like another AI, a duplicate AI that is learning and helping the other one learn by competing, and then they learn from their mistakes. It's become very powerful. So new artificial intelligence systems are using quote-unquote adversarial networks to develop creativity and originality by more fluidly mixing and matching real-world information. American poet Ralph Waldo Emerson said, quote, every artist was first an amateur, and he likely never thought those words were applied to machines. Yet artificial intelligence has demonstrated a growing aptitude for creativity. Remember, we read about the mentally unstable creative AI. We're going to read about that again here in a few minutes. And yet artificial intelligence has demonstrated a great aptitude for creativity, whether writing a heavy metal rock album, and don't listen to it. I don't know, anytime I listen to that AI music, it made my head feel weird, or producing an original portrait that is strikingly reminiscent of Rembrandt and looks like it is art from somebody who is mentally ill, I'm going to add. And applying AI to the art world that might look like your dystopian nightmare might seem an unnecessary derivative. There are, of course, plenty of humans delivering awe-inspiring artwork, but proponents say, however, that the real beauty of training AI to be creative does not lie in the end product, but rather in the technology's potential, to expand on its own machine learning education and to solve problems by thinking outside of the box far faster and better than humans can. Ding, 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 ding. For example, creative problem solving AI could someday make snap decisions to save the lives of passengers in a self-driving car if its sensors fail. And to not slam them into a wall, which we read about, that was a big ethical consideration a long time ago, whether or not to hit all the passengers on the sidewalk or slam the driver into a wall, or propose unconventional combinations of chemical compounds that lead to new drugs for things such as malaria, like we had just read about. An AI with a creative streak will be essential in developing highly automated systems that can respond appropriately to human life, says Mark Rydell, an associate professor at the Georgia Institute of Technology's School of Interactive Computing. The fact is, we do lots of little bits of creativity every single day. Lots of problem solving goes on. But if my son gets a toy truck stuck under the couch, he will have to devise a tool out of a hanger to retrieve it. Rydell points out that human creativity is also important to human social interaction, even telling a well-timed joke or recognizing a pun. Computers struggle with such subtleties. An incomplete understanding of how humans construct metaphors, for example, was all it took for an experiment in AI-generated literature to compose a new Harry Potter chapter filled with nonsensical sentences such as "the floor of the castle seemed like a large pile of magic." Still getting machines to accurately mimic human style, whether Rembrandt's or J.K. Rowling's, perhaps is a good place to start when developing creative AI. After all, human creators often start off imitating the skills and the processes of accomplished artists. The next step for both people and machines is to use those skills as part of a strategy to create something original. And that's the one thing. They are working on a lot of biologically inspired engineering. We've read about that Weiss Institute many times. That is their whole tagline, is the Weiss Institute of Biologically Inspired Engineering, where they're trying to recreate machines and different things that mimic humans and the way that we do things. They're trying to reverse engineer the human brain, and maybe we can talk about that for a few minutes. But here's one of the things I want to go back to, and this is this mentally unstable AI. We had read about them a few months ago, and Jake Anderson from Anti-Media actually picked up some of that research. Ramathan wrote a story, so we're going to read his story today. New artificial intelligence designed to be mentally unstable. What could possibly go wrong? My premise, exactly. So we tend to think of artificial intelligence as flawless intellects, early prototypes of the powerful Arctelect. Futurists imagine that one day they will rule our world. We also tend to think of them as not being subject to unhappy thoughts or feelings, but one company has created an artificially intelligent machine learning system that suffers from mental instability, or the AI equivalent, and that their creators deliberately designed it to be unstable. This tortured artist of AI is called Davis for short, and that is the device for autonomous bootstrapping of unified sentience. And it was created by computer scientist Stephen Thaler, who used a technique called generative adversarial networks, ding, 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 to mimic extreme fluctuations in thought and emotions experienced by humans who suffer from mental illness. His Missouri-based company called Imagination Engines, remember we read about Imagination Engines and their Imagitron, developed a two-module process, the Imagitron, diffuse digital noise into a neural network, causing Davos to generate new ideas and content because of the background noise, and then a second neural network called the Perceptitron, which I didn't read about that part, was integrated to access Davos's output and provide feedback. Then they added their secret sauce, and this method created an echo chamber between neural networks. And that is not new or unique. However, what Thaler and his company are using it for, which is deliberately tweaking an AI's cognitive state to make its artistic output more experimental, is the process triggers quote-unquote unhappy associations and fluctuations in its rhythm. And the result is an AI interface with symptoms of insanity. At one end, we see all of the characteristic symptoms of mental illness, hallucinations, attention deficit, and mania, Thaler says, describing Davos's faculties and temperament. And at the other hand, we have a reduced cognitive flow and a depression. Thaler believes that integrating human-like problem-solving and human-like flaws such as mental illness may significantly enhance AI's ability to create innovative artwork and subjective output. And while everyone is familiar with the psychedelic and surreal canvases by Google's DeepMind algorithm, they may be uniquely impressed by the more measured and meditative work of Davis. And I have to say, it is pretty interesting looking. Thaler also believes this technique will improve the abilities of AI in stock market prediction. Oh, you gotta love that. And autonomous robot decision making. Just what we want. By mentally ill autonomous robots. And what the risks are of infusing mental illness into a machine mind. Well, Thaler believes that there are limits, but that psychological problems could be just as natural to AI as they are to humans. The AI systems of the future will have their bouts of mental illness, Thaler speculates, especially if they aspire to create more than what they know. So I don't know about that, guys. I think mentally unstable artificial intelligence has to be one we put on the list to watch for in the future. So this one was pretty neat, too. New AI can make drawings based on verbal descriptions. And this is something that is coming out of Microsoft. January 22nd, 2018, out of geek.com. Many of you, not me, installed Google's art and culture app to see which famous portraits AI thought you looked most like. Microsoft AI researchers have been working on something in the same vein. Instead of matching the uploaded images to other existing images, however, the team at the company's Deep Learning Technology Center have been training artificial intelligence to create images from scratch. All the AI needs is a list of keywords to go by, and to be clear, what is going on in the image at the top of this article is not what happens when you go to Google or Bing and perform a search. The AI did not sift through a stash of images to find something that matched up with your keywords. Instead, principal researcher Zia Dong says, here the pictures are created by the computer pixel by pixel from scratch. And actually, the picture of this little canary looks pretty realistic, I have to be honest. There is no guarantee that you would find what the AI produces in an Audubon guide either. He goes on to say that these birds may not exist in the real world. They're just an aspect of our computer's imagination. Ding, ding, ding of birds. Guys, they're really working on this stuff. So now let's add a little bit of insanity and see what it spits out. The team also fed the bot more outlandish suggestions to see how it would respond. A yellow and a black bird is simple enough, and there's plenty of source material to draw on, and it wasn't even certain what to make of a red double-decker bus floating on a lake. And while a human artist could have sketched that up easily enough, the AI produced a blurry, drippy image that resembles both a boat with two decks and a double-decker bus on a lake surrounded by mountains. Why the difficulty? Well, the AI knows what the bus looks like, and it knows what a lake is, and it also knows that the lake is not a bus's natural habitat, but logic is getting in the way, so the bot throws in the boat because it is the kind of vehicle that it expects to appear in the water. That doesn't make what Microsoft's bot can do any less impressive, and it will become more human-like as researchers find mathematical ways to mimic human creativity. While you can't experiment with AI yourself, you can play around with another Microsoft project that has paved the way for it. And a few years back, they introduced CaptionBot, which will make an educated guess about the contents of an image that you upload. And that could actually be fun if you think about it. So take one of your most embarrassing pictures. Maybe not you, but someone you don't like, and have it spit out a caption. All right. So we had read about on Friday them building these atomic switches and making order out of chaos, creating these neuronal blobs out of whatever substance. It was some sort of silver oxide or silver melloid, something like that. Well, check this out. We also read about MIT making artificial synapses. This also came out of MIT Technology Review. It doesn't have a date on it, but this was just recent because January 29th. So it was yesterday. A new artificial synapse is faster and more efficient than the ones in your brain. Oh, look out, because here it comes. Time for an upgrade. Biologically inspired circuitry could help build future low-powered AI chips if some obstacles are overcome. Researchers at the U.S. National Institute of Standards Technology, and this would be NIST, the Global Standards Institute, built a new magnetically controlled electronic synapse, an artificial equivalent of the ones that link your neurons. They fire millions of times faster than the ones in your brain while using 1/1000th as much energy, which is also less than any other artificial synapse to date. Why it matters? Well, synthetic synapses, which gather multiple signals and fire electronic pulses at a threshold, may be an alternative to transistors in regular processors. So we'll be using these to create neuromorphic chips. that can be assembled to create so-called neuromorphic chips, which work more like brains, and such devices can run artificial neural networks, which underpin most modern AI, more efficiently than regular chips. This is going to put NVIDIA out of work if they don't get on the ball. This new Synapse could make them even more energy efficient, but the Synapses have not been used to create a large logical device, so it is not clear if it'll be a useful chip, if can be built from them as well. And they run at temperatures of 5K, which is too cold for a practical computing device. But hey, don't worry about it, because we're already working with quantum computers and superconducting materials that work at very low temperatures as well. Which leads us to the next story. This one is out of ScienceAlert.com from, again, yesterday, January 29th, 2018. This superconducting switch could be the missing piece for human-like AI brains. A new superconducting switch could soon enable computers to make decisions very similarly to the way that we do, essentially turning them into artificial brains. One day, this new technology could underpin advanced artificial intelligence systems that may become part of our everyday life, from transportation to medicine. Researchers at the, and this might be even the same project, the U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technology, more affectionately known as NIST, explained that much like a biological brain, the switch learns by processing the electrical signals it receives and then produces an appropriate output signal. And this is exactly what they've been talking about with some of their brain uploading technology and the brain DAX, the digital distributed autonomous corporations or organizations, mind uploading, putting us on the blockchain, is about how our thinking process is an input and an output system, and it boils down to that much simplicity. This process mirrors the function of biological synapses in the brain, which allows neurons to communicate with each other. This artificial synapse, which is described in a paper published in the Science Advances on Friday, January 26, 2018, has the shape of a metallic cylinder, and it is just 10 micrometers wide. It is designed so it can learn through experience or even just from its surrounding environment, and it is increasingly common in the field of AI. This synthetic switch performs even better than its biological components, ding, ding, using much less energy than our brains do. Well, that's pretty frightening. And firing signals much faster than human neurons, which would be a billion times per second. For comparison, our synapses fire about 50 times per second, and this fires at a billion times per second. How insane is that? This has a significant impact on processing, because the greater the frequency of electrical signals that are fired and received, the stronger the connection between the synapses become, because if you don't use it, you lose it. The switch is meant to boost the ability of so-called neuromorphic computers, which can support AI that one day could be vital to improving the perception and decision-making capabilities of the smart devices that surround us, such as our self-driving cars or even cancer diagnostic tools. The world's largest car makers are investing in technologies able to replace a human driver, but there is still a long way to go. And no matter how safe driverless cars will eventually become, they can lock the doors and do what they want at some point. The AI driver will eventually face moral dilemmas of having to decide whether to prioritize the safety of the passengers, and remember we talked about this, or others who might be involved in a collision, like the 50 people who are on the sidewalk that you're about to careen into. This switch could equip the artificial brains that make these decisions to have a more capacity to deal with these kinds of ethical conundrums. The switch could also help us develop more accurate AI that can diagnose diseases such as heart conditions and lung cancer, like the ones they're integrating with NVIDIA into some of these new scanning machines by like General Electric for fMRIs and things of that nature and CT scans. For example, doctors at John Radcliffe Hospital in Oxford, UK, remember a lot of that stuff's coming out of Oxford, have successfully tested an artificial brain that improves the ability of doctors to detect life-threatening heart conditions, and a startup suggested that its AI system could catch as many as 4,000 lung cancers per year earlier than human doctors. And I know already that the radiologists are probably shitting their pants because they can diagnose anything on an x-ray much better than doctors. And while AI could become a game changer in medicine, and that is how they're going to sell it to you, the conventional computers that run its system still struggle with the tasks of context recognition. This is because the NIST researchers say they don't keep memories the same way we do. Our brain both processes information and stores memories in synapses at the same time, while these computers can perform the two tasks separately. But the new artificial synapses address this problem, allowing computers to mimic the human brain. And although it is still being tested, researchers are confident that it may one day power a new generation of artificial brains that are able to improve on the current capabilities of AI systems. Well, there you have it. So I don't know if any of you caught the conference that was held on Sunday, this past Sunday, about reverse engineering the brain by carboncopies.org. I was in and out in the morning, but my family was here, and then we were gone in the afternoon, so I haven't caught up on the whole thing. I actually watched the very last presentation last night. They're doing all these horrifying experiments with little monkeys and mapping the brain. But it was pretty interesting because most of the conference was about how they were going to upload some of the contents of a person's brain. And a lot of it was being talked about doing after you'd been cryogenically frozen and then your brain sliced into little slices and imaged. And then I don't know, if you lost one slice, though, you were totally screwed. So I will link to that. There was a couple hours that I saw archived on YouTube. I don't know where the entire conference was, but it was very extensive. All right, so anyway, here's a paper that they referred to, again, out of Oxford, and it was titled Whole Brain Emulation, a Roadmap, from 2008. It was written by Anders Sandberg and Nick Bostrom. Nick Bostrom, I think, has been pretty instrumental in some of the artificial intelligence as well. He's one of the granddaddies. All right, so here's the introduction. Whole brain emulation, which is the possible future of one-to-one modeling of the function of the human brain, is academically interesting. The whole brain emulation represents a formidable engineering and research problem, yet one which appears to have well-defined goals and could, it would seem, be achieved by extrapolations of current technology. This is unlike many other suggested radically transformative technologies that are coming, like artificial intelligence, where we do not have any clear metrics of how far we are from success. In order to develop ideas about the feasibility of whole brain uploading and emulation, ground technology foresight, and stimulate interdisciplinary exchanges, the Future of Humanity Institute, and this is that same institute that Elon Musk is involved with, hosted a workshop on May 26th and 27th of 2007 in Oxford. It invited experts from such areas as computational neuroscience, brain scanning technologies, computing, nanotechnology, and neurobiology, and they presented their findings and discussed the possibilities, problems, and milestones that would have to be reached for whole brain emulation to become feasible. The workshop avoided dealing with socioeconomic ramifications and with the philosophical issues such as theory of mind, identity, and ethics. And, of course, we didn't talk about ethics at all. And while important, the discussions would undoubtedly benefit from a more comprehensive understanding of the brain, and it was this understanding that we wish to focus on further developing during the workshop. So I'm going to stop here for a minute because one of the things that was somewhat amusing during that reverse engineering the brain whole day webinar was that it was fraught with tech, which on the back end as a watcher didn't make you feel too confident in their abilities. Well, all right, so let's take one more jump because I don't want to read that whole paper. It's pretty long-winded. But this one caught my attention as well. January 23rd, 2018, out of Engadget.com, IBM researchers have now used artificial intelligence to predict your risk of developing psychosis just by analyzing your speech patterns. Now, you remember we've talked about them being able to diagnose disease just by the sound of your voice. Well, it looks like IBM, and I don't know if this is Dr. Watson or not, is getting into that game. IBM's computational psychiatry and neuroimaging research team have been working on a way to use machine learning to predict the risk of developing psychosis. So this is going to be pre-psychosis. And it just published a second study that shows that AI might be a valuable tool when it comes to a mental health assessment coming to a computer screen near you someday. Building off the work published in 2015, the team used AI to analyze the speech patterns of 59 individuals who had participated in a separate study. Transcripts of an interview the participants took were broken down into parts of speech and were scored on how coherent the sentences were, and then the machine learning model determined, based on those speech patterns, who was at risk of developing psychosis and who wasn't. Of those participants, 19 developed a psychiatric disorder within 2 years, while 40 did not. And the model was able to predict that with an 83% accuracy. It was also able to differentiate speech patterns of patients who had recently developed psychosis from those of healthy patients with a 72% accuracy. The program found that those at risk of psychosis used fewer possessive pronouns when speaking and constructed less coherent sentences. While the work is still ongoing, it shows that AI could be an effective tool, and it could be particularly useful when mental health professionals are in short supply or aren't available. And remember, we already had the Wobot online to be able to treat some of your depression. We believe this is a significant step toward the goal of developing a tool for mental health practitioners so we can diagnose your mental disease as part of the 21st Century Cures Act. Remember, there was a very large section involved with some new technologies and defining ways to coherently prove that someone has a mental illness on a spectrum, because we all do, remember. Toward goals of developing a tool for mental health practitioners, caregivers, and patients themselves with a tool that can expand and multiply the reach of neuropsychiatric assessments outside of the clinic. In the video below, the researcher says that they've been able to predict the risk of psychosis years in advance, and that could help medical and mental health professionals better allocate their resources and provide better care to those at risk, so they could send a preemptive white coat to come get you. Chichi points out that one area where this may have an impact is with the homeless, who likely don't have resources to seek out medical help. Given that I feel we can do something, I think we should, he says. Sorry, guys. Have an awesome Tuesday. I'm going to try to be back by Friday. Everybody take care.